And we have a responsibility to those. That's what community means. It's the responsibility to other members. It's the sense of self-sacrifice that, you know, we can't just use everything for ourselves, that there's other people involved here. And that's what community means. And our obligation to the next generation is expressed by the term sustainability. And all that word means is that God wants us to use the things that we've been given to enrich ourselves, to improve our quality of life, to serve others. But we can't use them up. We can't sell the farm piece by piece in order to pay for the groceries. We can't drain the pond to catch the fish. We can't cut down the mountain to get at the coal. We can live off the interest. We can't go into the capital. That belongs to our children. And what we do, you know, as environmental advocates and the Riverkeeper movement and all the other environmentalists, is we elbow our way into those courtrooms and into those back hallways of Capitol Hill where the big shots are with their indentured servants, you know, the big coal and big oil and ExxonMobil, to name a few, and General Electric Company and Cargill and Monsanto and, you know, these really bad actors. And they're back there with their indentured servants in the political process, cutting up the pie, the public trust assets that belong to all of us and to our children. The air, the water, stealing the breath from these young children in New York City who are being brought into a world where the air is too poisonous for them to breathe so that somebody can make an extra buck in the Ohio Valley. And the water, and destroying the endangered species, and the wandering animals, and liquidating all those things for cash and stuffing their pockets. And we elbow our way into those convocations, to those cabals, and we say, we are emissaries for the future, and we demand an accounting. We want to know what you're doing with things that don't belong to you, to things that belong to our children. And I'll close with a proverb from the Lakota Indians that has been expropriated to some extent by the environmental movement, where they said, we didn't inherit this planet from our ancestors, we borrow it from our children. And I would add to that that if we don't return to them something that is roughly the equivalent of what we receive, that they'll have the right to ask us some really difficult questions. Thank you all very much, and thank you, Santosh. Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you very much. So, thank you. So if you can sit down, thank you so much. Then we'll take a couple of questions.
I know there's been talk about possibly filtering the Hudson and trying to deal with that issue, so I was wondering if you could address that.
Okay, the what is commonly referred to as the New York City watershed is the area, the 2,000 square miles upstate of New York City that surround the drain into the city's reservoir systems. And the city, you know, is famous for its drinking water. New York City's drinking water, formerly in the 70s and early 80s, won taste tests year after year. It was bottled and sold in other cities. It accounts for the incomparable taste of New York City pizza and New York City bagels. And this is true. In fact, they used to ship in the 70s. I don't know if they're still doing it, but they used to ship cases of New York City water to Miami to make bagels, you know, for the New York City expats who had moved to Miami. But the watershed, beginning really in the 70s, began to deteriorate, not because the population of the area changed, because it hasn't. The population of our area really has maintained static since the 1960s. But the way that we're deploying the population, which is sprawl, you know, spreading it out along the landscapes rather than keeping it in New York City, which is the ideal way. That's why the most important thing for environmentalists to do is to make sure that we have livable cities that are attracting people into them where resources can be used efficiently and not, you know, pushing them out with giant subsidies, of course, to sprawl the landscape. But the biggest reservoirs are in the Catskill Mountains. A few years ago, the EPA ordered the New York City to filter its drinking water because they saw the Catskills were coming under development. I ended up with the clinic suing and Riverkeeper suing the city. We had 9 separate lawsuits against the city for allowing the pollution of its own reservoirs and against many of the upstate towns, the 75 towns. We ended up, and it's a long story, but we ended up sitting with Governor Pataki, working a partnership with him where we got everybody to sit in a room for almost 2 years and hammer out an agreement. And it was a very, very rough negotiation where actually, the first meeting, one of the farmers from the Catskills stood up and pointed to the governor and said, if you think that you're going to allow 1 acre of land to be purchased in Delaware County by New York City to protect this water, we will meet you on Route 23 with our shotguns, and we will make the Oklahoma City bombing look like child's play. This was in the first meeting of this group. And anyway, we sat down for 2 years, and people finally calmed down. And we got an agreement that is 1,500 pages long. There was bloodshed over almost every word in it. But it forces the New York City to spend $1.5 billion upstate in these local communities, rebuilding sewage treatment plants, rebuilding infrastructure. Also, there's a lot of money, hundreds of millions of dollars for green development in those communities, so that to attract businesses that don't pollute into those communities. And the purpose is to allow these communities to prosper, these 75 towns, to prosper, and in exchange for that, the towns agreed to freeze development in the outlying areas so that the landscapes will be preserved and the cities, the little towns, the existing hamlets within the infrastructured areas will grow upwards but not outwards. And in that way, and that's what the purpose of the agreement is, it's an historic agreement and it can really work, but you need a strong mayor in New York City who's willing to stand up to the developers, and that's not always happening.
How effective are you being with methods that you're using to get the subsidizers and the polluters to behave? I guess my question really is there any conversation that you're aware of that would include the people that we're saying are the bad guys? As parents and as people who have the same concerns that we do.
Yeah, I mean, I forgot who said it, but yeah, power is not, you know, ever conceded without a demand. So the conversations we have with these people are usually in court. We need, you know, strong government officials who will stand up and you know, I don't even consider myself an environmentalist anymore. I'm a free marketeer, and what we do is we patrol the marketplace and we track down the people who are violating it, and we say to them, we're going to force you to internalize your costs the same way as that you internalize your profits and stop externalizing them and forcing the public to pay them. And it's all about the free market. If we can get the free market to work, we handle our waste efficiently. Inefficiency is waste. Waste is pollution. We eliminate that if we have efficiency.
Thank you very much.
You were listening to a talk by Robert Kennedy Jr. given September 4th, 2003 at the Water of Life, Perils and Promise in the 21st Century Conference in Rhinebeck, New York. This is on Welcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio, Santa Cruz. Our next speaker will be Tony Clark, director of the Polaris Institute in Toronto. He will discuss the corporations leading the push for water privatization and the strategies being employed for those defending the commons against this incursion.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you to Resurgence for organizing this and for the Amiga Center. And for all of you that are here, because we are on the threshold of a whole new era with regards to the environment, which focuses in on the whole question of water and water resources for the future. I want to start off with a story of action that goes right back to the World Water Forum that was held in Kyoto in March. The World Water Forum is that venue or vehicle that's been put together by the major water corporations, by the World Bank, by the IMF, to pave the way for privatization, to show that the private sector is the vehicle for salvation to the world's water crisis. And so what happened then in Kyoto was the gathering of 6,000 to 10,000 people from all over the world. Many of the people were largely innocent, didn't know one way or the other what was up or down, a lot of municipal officials, etc. And we organized an international civil society network that started off to be about 75 people, ended up close to 100 people, working together in intervention teams. And we wanted to intervene in some of the major sessions to provoke debate, to stop this kind of mantra that privatization and the corporate takeover of the world's water was the only answer to the world's water crisis. So when we gathered together and put together our strategies, one of the events happened to be around there was a event around food and water, around food and water and energy, water and climate change, water and cities, and so forth. And then there was also this event where the CEOs of the big corporations were all going to gather on stage, and they were going to present their best stuff. So we got ourselves quite well organized for that. We started planning, and then we got a hold of the program, and we knew what they were going to do. Except the same night that we were strategizing, they were also strategizing, in which we didn't know at the time, in another room in a hotel across the way. And they changed their plan. So when we arrived in this big hall, it was seated about 2,300 people. We had people from all over the world, from Asia, from Africa, from Latin America, as well as Europe and North America. And we were geared up for it, but we all of a sudden had to change our tactics right on the spot. What happened was they started to move with their program, and finally we just started to interrupt one after another. And then we hit the microphones, and we gathered around the microphones, and we controlled the microphones from the outside. And one after another, beautiful testimonies, beautiful stories of the other side of what's really happening with these corporations, where it was told by these people as they stood one after another. And then towards the end, there was a man that got up to the microphone from Cancun, Mexico. And he came and he said, you know, our water services, our water has been privatized by the corporation Suez. And let me show you what kind of water we have. And he brought a glass of water that was pitch black. Pitch black. And he showed it to everybody. And then he said to the moderator, I want you to pass that back to those water corporations at the back, and particularly to the CEO of Suez. And that's exactly what happened. Pitch black, smelly water that he had taken out of the tap. And this is the action that was going on to counter the big water corporations there in Kyoto. I think it's really important that we try to grapple with the fact that this is what these water corporations, this is what the World Water Forum agenda is all about. It is about trying to set the stage for a whole policy agenda for governments to follow. It's the corporations determining what governments will do in the area of resource management and water management. And it's largely because governments have abdicated their responsibility. They're allowing the private sector and allowing the corporations to determine and dictate the rules under which water resource management will take place in the future. And this is the really critical agenda that I think we need to keep in mind. When we talk about the World Bank and the IMF pouring billions and billions of dollars into the private sector and financing the opening up of public water systems to these corporations, that's what's really going on here, is that the corporations are clearly setting the agenda, determining the rules, and developing the new form of governance under which water will be managed in the future. Now, who are these corporations? Who are these big players? Well, it's important that we start to get them firmly fixed in our mind. There are three big multinational corporations that we need to know about. First of all, there is Vivendi, which is still the largest water corporation in the world. Vivendi is a multi-sector corporation. It's a big entertainment corporation as well. But it has a huge sector of its operations dealing with water around the world. The second is Suez. And Suez operates in 130 countries in the world. It is the second in terms of revenue generation for water of all the water corporations in the world. And it is present in many, many countries. The third is a company called RWE. And that is a company, a German company, a multi-sector service company that bought out Thames Water, which was the largest British company, and has now positioned itself to be a major contender in terms of the takeover of water services around the world. These are the big three. Suez and Vivendi are based in France. RWE is based in Germany. There was another contender that was on its way a couple of years ago, wanting to get right into the market and take over and challenge the two front runners, Vivendi and Suez. And that was a corporation by the name of Enron. And Enron had bought up another company, British water company, and then created something called Azurix. And Azurix Water was their flagship operation, going to be their flagship operation in terms of the takeover of water services. But it's very interesting to attract what happened on Enron. All you have to do is watch how they handled their water company, and you see exactly what happened to Enron. The same story played itself out in both cases. I won't go into that except to say these are the big players, these are the big corporate players that are out there that are driving this agenda. Now, they have a long-range strategy, and it's really important that we keep this in mind. They know what the facts are. They know, on the one hand, that the demand for water is doubling, consumption of water is doubling every 20 years in the world. That's twice as fast as the rate of population growth, doubling every 20 years, and on the one hand. And then on the other hand, they also know that the supply of water is dwindling rapidly. That by the year 2025, the demand for water will outstrip supply by 56% in the world. Now, you figure it out. When you get demand like that, you get supply like that, you get rising demand, you get diminishing supply, the result is scarcity, water scarcity. That's when the marketplace comes in. That's when the corporations come in. And the end result is, of course, commodification and making water a major profit-making operation. You're talking about an industry now that is touted by the World Bank to be potentially in the area, totally right across the board, all forms of water management and operations, to be somewhere in the neighborhood of a $1 trillion industry. We're talking big time here. The corporations I was just mentioning, Vivendi and Suez, and particularly RWE, all three of these corporations are within the top 100 corporations in the world in terms of revenue generation and in terms of profits. We are talking about big entities and big business now, and it's going to get bigger and bigger and grow bigger. One of the interesting things, though, that's happened is that through the whole push on the part of the World Water Forum to try to get these private companies to go in and take over the public water systems in third world countries and to be the savior of the world, the water crisis at that level. That one of the problems that's occurred is that there's been a series of private sector fiascos in the third world. We can just mention five of them really quickly right now. Manila. The company Suez was in Manila. It has botched the job badly. It has not extended the service to poorer communities. The water is often discolored, and as a result, you're faced with a situation where people simply cannot drink the water. And the result has been that Suez has recently just announced that it will pull out of Manila. That was a huge contract. Jakarta was another one. Jakarta, Indonesia. There again, a deal was made through the Suharto regime to get the contract to run the water system. And there have been many protests around that in Jakarta over the years. And now, again, the cracks are showing, and it looks like Suez is in real trouble as far as Jakarta is concerned. Let's look at Buenos Aires. That was the flagship operation of third world water privatization. And it was touted as the example to follow. Watch what we do in Buenos Aires. Suez took over the operation there. It managed to get out of the $1 billion that was to be invested in the operation, 97% of that came from, not from the company, but from public sources like the World Bank and the IMF and a few other smaller banks. In other words, this business and this myth about the fact that the water corporations will invest and put money in themselves into these operations is a total myth altogether. And now what's happening is, because of the Argentinian currency crisis, Suez has lost a fair amount, and it's now prepared. It's now announced that it is ready to pull out. It hasn't pulled out yet, but it is on the brink of pulling out of Buenos Aires. Johannesburg, they've taken over. Suez has taken over the operations in, of the water company, the water operations in Johannesburg, South Africa. But once again, what's happening in South Africa is that, as Maude was indicating, is that there are massive cutoffs of water all over the place. The poorer communities, the townships, don't have access to water because they can't afford to pay the rising costs and the rising prices for water. The result has been that people find themselves cut off of water. 10 million people throughout South Africa have at one time or another been faced with fairly long periods of water shutdown and water cutoff. And this is in a country where water is supposed to be recognized as a right in the Constitution itself. And finally, in New Delhi, we will hear more about this from Vandana, I'm sure, tomorrow. But then Suez has moved in, set up its operations in terms of running the water services in New Delhi. You have a company the company has taken over there, and what's happened is that very recently 5 workers were killed because of the way in which the plant. What happens is that when these companies move in, they immediately downsize the workforce. And when you downsize the workforce, one of the fallouts is health and safety situations, and the result is, in this case, is that 5 workers were killed, and there have been other workers killed in other plants and operations. And this is the kind of mess that's going on as far as these operations in these countries are concerned. So there have been these private sector fiascos. And the result of all of this is that now what's happened is that coming into the Kyoto World Water Forum earlier this year, Suez announced, followed by Vivendi saying similar things, that they are going to follow a different kind of strategy in the future. Their strategy will be that they will, in this case Suez, will pull out of 1/3 of its operations in the third world and move its investment and operations elsewhere. Secondly, it will not invest in any new big water operations in the third world until it gets clear, guaranteed financing and protection for all of its operations. How do you like that for free market and free enterprise and risk-taking, huh? And then the third part of this component is that they are going to concentrate now their operations and their investment on more secure markets, targeting North America and Europe. And that's where I want to turn to now, is what are we faced with in terms of North America? What are we faced with here in the United States? What is going to be the picture that's going to unfold with regards to these large corporations now taking over the running of our water services? Well, I don't know if it'll come as a surprise to you or not, but one of the great things that still remains in public hands in the United States is water. Is water services. 85% of all water services in this country is still in public hands. But for those corporations, that's a big target. They want to take over as much of that as they can in the future. And so what Suez and Vivendi are now saying, and RWE, is that they want to now target and focus their energies on North America. This is a lucrative market for them, and they now, within the next 10 years, want to be able to control 70% of water services that are delivered to your homes across America, across the United States. This is the situation that we're now faced with. Furthermore to that, they have positioned themselves to move in this direction very aggressively. First of all, they've set up for themselves, each of them, major subsidiaries to operate here in the United States. In the case of Suez, their number one company is United Water Resources. In the case of Vivendi, it's called U.S. Filter. And in the case of RWE, it is called American Water Works. What they have done is come in and bought up the leading water companies that existed before, that serviced largely small towns and communities, and they have now turned these into the engines for privatization and takeover here in the United States. And they are going to operate in a way that will follow the tradition in which these companies have operated elsewhere. They have enormous gifts and skills and talents and techniques in being able to operate politically. They know what it means, of course, in terms of grabbing a hold of the political financing operation here in the United States. They know the difference between soft money, and they know what to do with that. They know how to make sure that their money gets in the right hands, and they are well on their way in that direction. It's interesting to watch even somebody like Marilyn Ware, who is the chair of the board for American Water Works, which is the subsidiary of RWE, poured something like $350,000 into Republican campaigns in the last federal and national election. And President Bush turns around and appoints her to the committee that will largely oversee questions of privatization and public infrastructure in the country. That's the kind of influence and power that's being exerted. There are many other examples when we look at the makeup of these companies in terms of the people that are on their boards, etc. But clearly there are, and I'm sure Ralph will be talking about various aspects of this himself, maybe the legislation, like the new tax laws that have come in that really favor and foster privatization that are in place, the emphasis now on public infrastructure and federal and state flows of money for those purposes, and how built into that are new incentives for privatization as well. All of these things are a part of the new lobbying processes that are going to go on with regards to the privatization of water services here in the United States. And of course, they're able to play on the problem of decaying infrastructure. There's no question that across the United States, as well as many parts of the world, including my own country, that we are dealing with very, very decaying infrastructure. We're dealing with the problem of old pipes and the need, and leaky pipes, and the need to replace much of the infrastructure that was put in place in many cases 100 years ago. So this is going to be something that they will play on and work on to try to foster this kind of process that we're talking about. At the same time, these companies are very, very adept in working in local communities. They know what it means to work the local politicians, to dine them, to give them tickets to sports games, to be sports events, to be able to maneuver in terms of the local newspapers and the local media itself, and to make sure they put together citizen front groups that are going to start talking about how nice it would be if we had a private water company running our water services, and how much more efficient they would be in the long run. All of that is going to happen, and all of that is unfolding. We know about the larger contracts to some extent. We know about Indianapolis, which is the largest contract so far, a $1.5 billion contract in Indianapolis. We know about the contract in Atlanta, which I'll come back to in a moment. Big contracts in Milwaukee. You've got Detroit, you've got Buffalo, you've got Seattle, a number of other places where there have been portions of contracts or parts of contracts with regards to the running of parts of their water systems in some of those cities. So there is definitely a toehold that's been established. Keep in mind, though, their agenda is to look ahead at the next 10 years. And by the 10 years from now, to have control over 70% of these water services across the country. That's the challenge that we're faced with, and that's what we're going to be up against. I want to turn for a moment to bottled water and to show that this is really the flip side of public water systems. Why is it the flip side? Because, for one thing, it is the fastest growing part of the water industry. It is a part of undermining the confidence in any kind of public water system. It goes hand in hand with the push towards the privatization of water services. These are locked together. And even though you have a different set of players that are driving the bottled water industry, they are in tandem and operating in tandem with the three big water corporations that I mentioned. And so we need to keep this thing in mind. $35 billion last year were the annual sales with regards to bottled water around the world. Fastest growing sector here in the United States, $7.7 billion was spent on bottled water. That's 11% increase over 2001. So that gives you an idea of how fast and big this industry is as it grows. Who are we talking about? You know who we're talking about. You know, my room, there's this thing, Poland Springs, right? Oh, here it is. Poland Springs, right? Bought out by Nestle's. Nestle's had 68 brands of bottled water. 68 brands. It is the largest bottled water company in the world. And Poland Springs is now one of its flagship operations. In the case of what's happening, though, is that Nestle's is not going to have that for very long because there's going to be a huge and major drive by the two big beverage corporations, namely Coca-Cola and Pepsi. Coca-Cola and Pepsi have vowed to fight each other off for control of bottled water, not only here in the United States, but throughout the world. And they have also vowed that within 10 years from now, they will be on top and they will control the bottled water industry in the world. They have also said, in the case of Coca-Cola, that within a very few years, bottled water will surpass the traditional product of Coca-Cola, its Coke product. So we are talking about a huge push in the area of bottled water by some very big corporations that have obviously very high name recognition, and we know what they're all about. But the differences, and I think it's really important to understand some of the differences in terms of how they operate. Nestle's is a company that operates in this country. It gets its water from streams and from aquifers and from wells, and it now has control over 75 sites around the United States for access to water. The classic case, I guess, is I think it's in Michigan, is Muskoka, is it something like that county in Michigan? Pardon me? Macassa, community there where apparently there's 260 million gallons a year are sucked out of this aquifer that's a part of the new Nestle operation. Nestle got that contract, as I understand it, with a $150 licensing fee and then a whole pile of tax breaks on top of it, right? So that's the kind of operation that they've set up. In the case of Coca-Cola and Pepsi, they don't go that route. They go another route. They decide to take it all from the municipal tax or the municipal water system, suck it out of the municipal water system, and they take that water, which is pretty, which is really, really cheap, and they take that water, they add their mineral packages to it, and they turn the stuff into bottled water, and then they sell it to you at an enormously high profit rating on top of that. What you're dealing with, of course, is really a scam with regards to the sale of bottled water, 1,100 times what it would cost otherwise. In other words, every bottle of Dasani you take or Aquafina you take, you're paying 1,100 times what you would pay for the same amount of water if you took it out of the tap. And that's the kind of scam that's being perpetrated on people everywhere. And it's being perpetrated everywhere because what we're dealing with here is a youth culture that is being constantly worked at over and over again. They have targeted youth. They have gone into the schools. We all know about this in terms of Pepsi and Coca-Cola and the schools. We have a situation in Canada where a school, the contract had been taken over by Coca-Cola, and they had a day that was honoring fresh drinks and things like that, and people came out, and this kid came out with a Pepsi T-shirt, and he was expelled from school for wearing a Pepsi T-shirt at a school that had a Coca-Cola sponsorship. That goes to show you how deep and how the level that they're prepared to go up. They want to create a new youth generation of consumers of bottled water, not of tap water, not of confidence in a public water system, but of bottled water and the way to go in terms of that form of privatization. We've talked about the environmental impacts already, of just how how incredible the situation is environmentally with bottled water. When you have 1.5 million plastic bottles created, billion plastic bottles created every year, what that does in terms of the environment, what it's doing in terms of the wastage that goes on, that out on the Hudson River, they have said that 18% of all of the refuse that they pick up are plastic bottled waters. When you think of the fact that of all the bottled water that's out there and the way it's thrown away, 9 out of 10 times that those plastic bottles end up in waste disposal and not in recycling operations. So this is a very, very serious problem environmentally as well. And then when we add to all of that the fact that this is going to grow and expand at a very rapid rate. It's not whistling Dixie when Pepsi Cola and Coca Cola say they're definitely going to move and take over. They've got the infrastructure in place. It's called their bottled water operations and their plants around the world. And again, if we had the charts, we could see that where these bottled water operations exist and how prominent both Pepsi Cola and Coca Cola are. Coca Cola has 80 bottling plants located throughout North America in very strategic locations. And in the case of Pepsi Cola, it's something like 73 or so. They have major operations in place, and they can expand and move in that direction at a very rapid rate. And these are the kinds of things I think we need to really look out for and understand what's happening. So finally, I just want to wrap this up by saying that I think we are faced with a huge challenge as we look ahead in the next decade here in North America. And I think it's important that we start to think in North American terms, not just in U.S. terms, not just in Canadian terms, not just in Mexican terms. And the reason for that is twofold. Number one is that, for one thing, we're talking about water that's a part of the environment and part of bioregions that don't know borders all that well, don't follow the dictates of what happens across borders. The second reason is that the same corporate players that are coming at us from, in this case, from Europe in terms of water services or internally in terms of bottled water, are aimed at the same places and the same markets. And we have got to learn to work together to develop some common strategies on a continental basis so we start to look at this and strategically in those terms. One of the things that was so striking at the World Water Forum in Kyoto, when we had this incredible international civil society delegation and people working together in teams from all different countries and learning from one another and respecting one another, is that you've got the feeling that that can happen on a global level, but it's also got to happen at a continental and regional level as well. And we've got to figure out ways of doing this. And that's why organizations like Public Citizen and the Council of Canadians, Polaris Institute, which is my own institute, and other kinds of organizations are starting to work together and to start to build a common strategy and a common game plan. So we think that if this challenge is facing us in the next 10 years, we've got to look at those water privatizations, we've got to look at that bottled water operations, and we've got to look at the water takings, and we've got to develop those kinds of strategic capacities to take that on. And what we're saying is that we've got to build a new water watch movement, if you will, around those kinds of issues that would work in tandem with the river keepers networks and the groups that are working on dams and everything else to build that kind of networking and that kind of coalitional approach to taking on these agendas and taking on these corporate players. That's going to be crucial. And we've got to do it around a common set of principles. And those principles have to do with, first of all, talking about the water of life, as you talk about it here in Kyoto and the movement we've built there. We talked about it, water is life, and other people have talked about it and saying water for life. Doesn't matter what the preposition or the in between. The question is, water equals life. And we must not allow it to be commoditized, modified, privatized, or taken over by corporations. And so we have to build a concerted strategic approach in North America. It's not enough for us in Canada to look at three or four cities and see that on one hand American Water Works is operating here and United Water over there, without realizing that those same companies are very much present and operating in numerous cities throughout the United States. We must build those alliances and build those connections, learn from one another, challenge one another, start to build this frontal attack that's going to be crucial. The same thing with bottled water and what is happening in terms of the bottled water operations in our various countries. We must build this together and build this movement. So we've been looking at three different things. One is the need for a water alert mechanism, where we not only know where these companies are operating. I have lists and lists and lists here of where they're operating in different U.S. cities across this country. We have some idea of what's happening there. But where are they going to next? How are they going to build this market for the next 10 years? Where are their targets? How are they going to move? And to be able to get ahead of the game. This is the kind of water alert mechanism we need to put in place in North America and watch where these companies are operating. Secondly, we need to put together water action teams that not only promote the national campaigns of that we find with Public Citizen or with the Council of Canadians and those kinds of groups, but we've got to also increase or provide opportunities for citizens and their own communities to come together to build their own Water Watch coalitions and to have the capacity to develop their own campaigns themselves and to link those campaigns with the other national campaigns that are going on. This is the kind of organizing that needs to go on place by place across the country, targeting areas where there's bottled water takeovers, targeting areas where there's moves to take over the public water system, and to build that kind of offense right across the board, and to have the linkages that are going on between these water action teams. And the third thing we need to do is to really concentrate on what we call water alternatives. It is not enough to be able to say, in the case of our public water systems, well, we want to defend our public water system over and against a private takeover. Because many of us know there are things that are wrong with the public water systems. And we must start changing that and building in new ways of revitalizing the water systems in our own communities. And the ways we have to do this is putting much more emphasis on the importance of citizen participation and action as watchdogs, as keeping on top of these issues and following what's happening. You know, in the city of Porto Alegre in Brazil, back in 1989, when the Brazilian Workers' Party took over the running of the city and the city government, they said, we're going to bring in a new politics. We're going to bring a new way of doing things. Well, it's not enough just to elect people every 4 years or every 2 or 3 years to perform a certain function in government. We have to have lively, ongoing citizen involvement. And they put together, what they did was the city is divided into 16 districts, and they put together these citizen forums in each of these 16 districts, and the people started neighborhood by neighborhood identifying what the priorities were and the issues were, and water was one of the major priorities. And so they started to build a network of citizen and neighborhood activists and people working on water issues around the city of Porto Alegre, and then made a connection between that and the public water system itself. And what's happened now is the public water system is largely driven by citizen participation on an ongoing, almost day-by-day basis. And it's that kind of model, that kind of new revitalization of democracy and democratic control that we have to start thinking about, I think, with regards to our public water systems and the future and the directions in which we move in. One final thing I want to say, and that is this. That we must recognize that the principles that we must fight for are threefold. One is water conservation. We cannot kid ourselves about the scarcity and the potential scarcity and problems of water. It may be abundant in one place, it's scarce in another. We have to think globally about this, and we have to recognize that we must practice water conservation at all levels, and that must be a top priority. A number two priority is water equity. People need water to live. It should be and must be a universal right. Therefore, it must be provided equitably to all people and not on the basis of the ability to pay. And finally, what I've just been talking about, water democracy. We cannot leave the running of our most precious resource in the hands of whether they're well-intentioned bureaucrats in government or the private corporations. We cannot allow that to happen. We, the people, must preserve this special trust, and we must fight for it, and we must take our proper role and demand water democracy. Thank you very much.
Hi. Yeah, I'm Peter McDonald from Collingwood, Ontario, Canada. I work there with an organization called the Blue Mountain Watershed Trust Foundation. My question is basically a strategy and tactics one, I guess. When you're talking about Coke and Pepsi cranking up to be the really big players in the wake of the three currently big players, it's about organizational models and organizational tactics. Is what we do now sufficient to deal with that, or do we need to make a paradigm jump into something that keeps up with them, given the 10-year timeline, for instance, to the kind of watershed things we're approaching? You know, I start thinking about grassroots, which is how we work in Collingwood, but then I start thinking about things like resistance movements, even guerrilla warfare, not that I'm counseling illegal activity. But if they're doing this at that scale of operation, that capitalized, not just by capital markets, but by public subsidy, what do we need to do organizationally to get there to stay up with them? I think you and your peers have done an absolutely phenomenal, inspirational job until now. But what do we need 10 years from now, tactically and in terms of organizational models? I'm kind of nervous because it's got my brain just cooking like a fool. But that's my question.
I think that what we have is a scattering of grassroots activities going on everywhere. I mean, a lot of places where people are really taking this up on their own, which is really important. And that must be preserved. But we must now build the infrastructure ourselves to sustain that and to get ahead of the game. That's why I said about the water alert mechanisms. It isn't enough just to know where things are happening now. We got to get ahead of the game. We got to know that United Water is moving into this community because we've seen that they've sent a lobbyist in to do some work with some local politicians. We need to get ahead of the game on this and to stop them from even getting inside the door if necessary. So we definitely have to build that capacity to do that, and that's why I've been sort of briefly said at the end, we do need to start putting in place a very serious investment ourselves in the kind of infrastructure that's going to be necessary that will help all of us, and we can learn from one another. Secondly, with regards to direct action and all of that, we have to keep in mind that the first water war of the 21st century was in Cochabamba, Bolivia. It was by hitting the streets that the people took out their outrage against the privatization by Bechtel over the water system there. And it was by getting hundreds of thousands of people onto the street that they eventually shut down the economy and forced Bechtel out. It may come to that. I doubt very much we're in that situation of being able to mobilize like that here in at least as far as I know in North America. But at least people, I think water touches people's lives so much that it's going to help motivate things in that direction, I hope.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sorry for the quickness.
Second.
We have a real powder keg. And I'm interested in what I can do today. When you said Vivendi bought U.S. Filter, my adrenaline just went over the top. My brother is one of the top salespeople with U.S. Filter. And I have a friend, coincidentally,
who's also a salesperson with U.S. Filter. I could call my brother this afternoon, and I've already talked to him about John Todd's work, and he's a very arrogant guy. I love my brother, but we are like, I think we are a microcosm. You know, this is personal. We are a microcosm of the polarity of us against them. And I feel like we have to really, right now, stop that. I want to be able to talk to my brother. My brother could influence U.S. Filter. I mean, and this to me, prevention, cure, all that. What I want to ask you and all of us, what are the tactics? What are the strategies we can use in our personal life? 6 degrees of separation. We all know each other on this planet. How can we influence each other artfully, poetically, gently, to change to a more humane way of living with each other? You know, how can we wake up and gently, how can I talk to my brother in a way that doesn't offend him and make him, because I do, I'm right, you know, I'm the opposite, and when opposites meet, it's collision. How can I be more effective?
Good question. Thank you. Good question.
Well, I think that when we ask the question, how can we be more effective, we have to start from where we are. So you've already identified where you are in relationship to your brother, et cetera, in U.S. Filter, but you're also an artist. So you may have to say, which can I go with for the moment to really make a move here? And I feel that one of the things that needs to be done is that artists need to get into communities to help young people see that there's another way of looking at their water. To not allow the commercialization and the corporate takeover mentality to run ahead. To not allow the logos and the labels and everything else and the designer this and designer that to be the way in which people look at the world. To help them through art see the world and see water in a different way. And I think that I'm sorry to use the word battlegrounds. I know it creates the image you don't want, but for me it is the real thing. we have to recognize that in our schools is one of the places. If you're into art, you've got a great contribution to make there. Okay?
Thank
I'll leave the brother thing a little later. Come to the workshop. We'll work that out.
Yes. Thank you. Sometimes questions are as important as answers. And you raise
absolutely
very important questions.
Very,
thank you for
very
that
good point. Yes.
I'm Sarah Van Gelder. I'm the editor of Yes Magazine, Bainbridge Island, Washington. And the reason, the question I have is about watershed councils and other ways in which people can form a visceral love relationship with their watersheds such that they wouldn't allow a private corporation to come in and take it over, and they wouldn't allow pollution and the other abuses of water. So I'm wondering if you have any sense of whether that kind of approach has the potential to sort of come in before the privatization efforts and create enough of a political constituency to prevent any success in that area. And related to that, there are some examples, as you mentioned, in Atlanta and elsewhere where private corporations have been asked to leave and the public has taken over again. And I wonder if there's any hints from those successes that you could give us about that would help us to see, you know, what we might do.
Well, again, I think this is a further question that can be really explored in the workshop stuff. I just want to say that Yes Magazine, I'm a real fan of it. If people want the answers in part to your question, read Yes Magazine, because you've done more on watersheds and exposing how people are networking around watersheds. It's a great resource for that purpose. I hand the ball back to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Question there.
Yes, I've been involved for...
Could you say your name?
My name's Terry Robin. I'm from Saratoga Springs, and I've been involved with the anti-war movement since I was a kid, and have, you know, certainly in the last few years, intensely. And okay, it seems to me that war is also being privatized, you know, in a big way, as far as, you know, the world didn't want the Iraq war, but we got it anyway. And I'm just thinking, with all of this, how does war... obviously, war impacts on water in a big way, in a worldwide way, but I'm not hearing a whole lot about, you know, depleted uranium and the effects on the water to all of us from the effects of war, and how, you know, how do we link the peace movement or people mobilizing against war with people mobilizing against the privatization of water, too, because it seems like the two are incredibly linked. So we need to somehow get all that energy that went into the peace movement into this, too.
Thank you. Yes.
Very, very brief response to that. Good question. Again, I agree with you, Satish. Let's hang on the questions, okay? There's a lot of meat there to work with. I mean, a lot of things to work with. But I just want to say that linking these issues is really important. I mean, in the case of the not just the war, the invasion of Iraq. The invasion of Iraq was not just, as a lot of people saying about oil. Let's keep in mind that one of the great water systems flows through Iraq, the Euphrates River. It's extremely strategic for the region itself, and therefore it wasn't just about oil, it was also about water, in my view anyway. And we should keep those things in mind, that these are real potential sources of more conflict and more struggles along these kind of lines. And, even the World Bank has been saying for years, the wars of the 21st century are going to be fought over water. But there is there's definitely a link there. So we have to keep that in mind and make sure that we don't create movements that are separate from the larger, in this case, the peace movement you're drawing attention to. Peace movement also has to listen to what we're talking about, too. Yeah.
Can you hold your questions for the next speaker? I have one more question, and then that'll be the last one. There.
Thank you. Hi, thank you for your work, Tony. I really appreciate it, as I'm sure everybody in this room does. My name's Karen Charman. I'm an independent investigative journalist specializing in environmental issues. And I just wanted to ask you if you could talk a little bit more about the linkages between the water distribution companies, those who would come and take over the water supply systems, and the Pepsis, the Cokes, the Nestles. That wasn't really clear to me.
Okay. Well, I think it's a question of looking at these two trend lines, and seeing what the potential connection can be. What we're seeing with the private water corporations wanting to take over public water systems is the undermining of the public water system itself. Showing that, whether it's the decaying of the infrastructure or the inefficiencies or whatever, that's the name of the game. So they play those things up as much as possible, right? One of the fallouts from that is that people are now saying, well, I can't trust the water that comes from the tap. I now move to bottled water and I start to consume bottled water, and this has become such a trend, and it's growing as a trend over here. Okay? But the two are linked in the sense that one reinforces the other in terms of this trend line and direction. Obviously, when the private corporations take over the running of the water system, they're going to want to restore confidence back in. But you're going to maybe see much more collaboration go on between a Pepsi and a Coca-Cola and a U.S. filter or whatever in the running of a water system. That could very well happen as well. And that's one thing. Secondly, we are talking about, in the case of Pepsi and Coca-Cola, taking their water from the municipal water system. So therefore, there's already a built-in connection, and it's in the interest of both to keep that going. But they wanted to keep going on in private hands and in corporate control, not in public hands, and not, and certainly not in citizen watch hands. And I think those are the things we've got to look out for and keep our eye on.
Okay? Thank you.
Is that helpful? Is that a little bit more helpful? Okay.
Thank you. Thank you again.
That was Tony Clark speaking at The Water of Life, Perils and Promise in the 21st Century, a conference held earlier this month. Tony Clark is the director of the Polaris Institute in Toronto. And thank you, Adelaide Gomer, for providing us with these recordings. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Come down like an unwell.